looking fella. But you're the one who killed South by Moonfest and Coachella.
I attack lungs, you infect minds. You cower before fascists because you have no spine. Let's try an experiment. The Holocaust never happened. You'll probably ignore that and just get.
Hello, I'm Neil Allen from Hudson, New York. You're listening to WGXE Acra 90.7 FM.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Tuesday, December 7th. Early on, we see 26 degrees in Turnwood and 33 degrees in Wemple. Things warm up just a bit, reaching 39 degrees by 1 p.m. Some lingering winds will be around, making things feel extra cold. Especially compared to yesterday. So don't forget a coat, even if that car is nice and warm. There is a chance for some of the Hudson Valley to get a lake effect dusting today. Overnight, temperatures drop to 27 degrees with almost no wind. Tomorrow, we'll have a high of 35. And up to an inch of snow is expected. Most will see light snowfall through the day, stopping shortly after dark, with a total accumulation of about a half inch. Overnight, mid-20s on the thermometer takes us into a calm Thursday with a high of 35. Friday, temperatures get into the 40s and rain returns to the region. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 4:57 a.m., low tide at 11:21 a.m., and high tide again at 5:18 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 40 degrees. Sunset today will be at 4:11 p.m. and sunrise tomorrow will be at 7:07 a.m. Looking way up, we see celestial alignment this evening. Venus, Saturn, Jupiter, and the Moon will be lined up in the southwestern sky just after sundown. Solar wind speed is currently 505 kilometers per second at 7.5 protons per milliliter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair up to 8 MHz for daytime and fair across the board for nighttime transmissions. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 3, quiet. The current sunspot number is 14. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Do you have 17 cents a day to support a platform for many diverse voices to have their say on the local airwaves? Just 17 cents a day, a monthly $5 recurring donation, can help keep local youth on the air at WGXE 90.7 FM. Your monthly sustaining support will keep the airwaves full of music from around the world and around the corner. WGXE needs 500 sustaining supporters to make sure there is one spot on the dial where the community can have access to its own airwaves. Make your pledge today at wgxc.org/donate and do your part to protect an important source of local news, information, and entertainment. With just 17 cents a day, you'll do your part to protect your favorite frequency. Become a sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org/donate now.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of FET Press in Hudson, New York. Sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a WGXC sustaining supporter by investing in community radio every month. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to Ginger Radio Hour. Welcome back. I'm Justin Maiman, You're listening to WGXC Acra, 90.7 FM. It was a blue sky morning here in the Catskills. The clouds are now starting to roll in a bit, which may be a perfect scene setter for today's show. Today is all about cataclysms, the Anthropocene, threats to these very mountains, and it's a little bit about hope, too. Or maybe a lot about hope. So here, let me set it all up for you. The Appalachia Journal, the new issue, is coming out in January. It's the winter-spring issue, and it's devoted, in part, to these very Catskills. The theme of the journal is Cataclysms in the Catskills and Taconics. Today, I have excerpts from two incredible essays in that journal, one by writer Hovey Brock and the other by Leslie Sharp, both Catskills residents. Hovey's going to read an excerpt from his piece called Crazier River. It's about the Neversink. And Leslie's going to read from the Bluebird Chronicles. Again, both of them are speaking, in part, to threats to these very mountains. Appalachia Journal, coming out in January, excuse me. I've seen several of the essays. I've read, of course, Hovey's and Leslie's. It's incredible. I encourage you to pick it up in January. I will have a link in the show notes to where you can subscribe to the journal. And if you don't know Appalachia Journal, it's America's longest-running journal of mountaineering and conservation. Go check it out online. And then subscribe, and then you get this beautiful magazine sent to you. But let's set the mood first with a little bit of music.
All the fight, the wind is gone, and this sweet world is so much older. The animals pull the night around their shoulders, flowers fall to their knees. I hear you've been out there looking for something to love. The dark frost that shifts at the edge of the tree. It's alright, it's alright. Will you turn so long and lovely? It's hard to believe that we're falling now. In the name of the Anthropocene, all the things we love, we love, we love, we lose. It's our bodies that fall when we're trying to rise. I hear you've been out looking for something to love. Sit down beside me and I'll name it for you. Behold, behold, the heaven-bound seas. The wind casts a shadow and it moves. Behold the animals and the birds and the sky and the tide. I hear you've been out there looking for something to set on fire.
The head bowed children fall to their knees. Humble in the age of the Anthropocene. Here they come now, here they come, are pulling you away. There are powers at play more forceful than we. Come over here and sit down and say you should pray. A prayer to the air that we breathe. The astonishing rise of the Anthropocene. Come on now, come on now. Hold your breath while you say. It's a long way back and I'm begging you please to come home now. Come home now. For something to love. Close your eyes, little world. Embrace yourself.
Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds with Anthropocene. That's from the Skeleton Tree album. I don't know why I went on the upswing there. Album. Nick Cave gives us the perfect setup for today's show. But I think he may have mellowed me out a bit here. So let's go the other direction. Let's try that again. Please hold.
Del desierto de Sonora, Tucson, Arizona, avenida feliz para el mundo.
Luchar. corre la patilla. Óyeme, carnal, te ten las mantasillas, que si llegas tarde, te corre la patilla.
Tienes que ir en chinga para poder llegar. Maneja con cuidado, no te vayas a matar. La gente ya te espera para verte luchar. La gente ya te espera para verte luchar.
No puedo, no puedo. Na, 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 na.
That was Mexican Institute of Sound with Sinfonía Agridulce. Of course, it's a cover of the Verve song, Bittersweet Symphony, but I think much improves upon the original. Again, that was Mexican Institute of Sound, and before that was Orquestra Mendoza featuring Mexican Institute of Sound with the song Cumbia Volcadora. Let's get back to the Anthropocene. Hovey Brock is a visual artist and writer based in Claryville and Brooklyn. And his essay in the New Appalachia Journal is called Crazier River, the Neversink River Goes Rogue in the Climate Crisis. He and I had a chance to talk last week, and he was kind enough to read an excerpt of the essay. And so before I go any further, I want to play that for you. It's really lovely. Here's Hovey Brock.
Neversink is a corruption of Enkuchahosi Sipu, meaning crazy river, and the Lenape tongue of the watershed's original inhabitants. The logging and farming practices of the European settlers did nothing to calm it down. In my lifetime, the Neversink's West Branch, where my family has been for generations, confirmed that reputation many times. In a rage, the clear water swelled to a torrent of red mud, coursing down the valley at 20 knots or more. At peak force, I can hear the rumble of boulders creeping along the riverbed. The West Branch springs from the northwest flank of Slide Mountain, the tallest peak in the Catskills, and runs 14 miles east to west through Frost Valley. The West Branch meets the East Branch, a junction pool to form the Neversink proper, which washes into the Delaware River. The West Branch has shaped my life as surely as it has worn the outcroppings of blue slate and red shale that punctuate its length. It carved out some of my earliest memories. Roaring waterfalls, shivering limbs, and slippery stone at Leroy Pool, where my extended family would congregate in summer. When I was 3, I came close to drowning by falling into Leroy's upper falls. Pinned by the powerful current, I remember feeling stunned, floating on my back while blinded by the sun refracted through the rushing waters. My Aunt Barbara saved the day. A former lifeguard, she dove in and pulled me out by the hair onto the rocks. No one remembers Mr. Leroy and his family who farmed that land, grazing their cattle and sheep over 100 years ago. Only the pool remains, part of a bequest of 5 square miles from Clarence M. Roof, a wealthy importer from Cooperstown, New York, to my grandmother, Jenny Franklin Cannell, née Hovey, upon his death in 1923. Before the European settlers wrested the land away from the Lenape, birch and hemlock covered the Catskills. Witnesses to the glacier's retreat from the northeast 10,000 years ago, virgin hemlocks were the dominant plant of the early Holocene. Some old growth still endures on slopes that are too steep or remote for logging. As hemlock's dense canopy keeps the understory dark and mossy, hemlock is a keystone species for the Catskills. Hemlock's riverside impact on the West Branch keeps the water several degrees cooler than that of the neighboring East Branch. At Leroy Pool, hemlocks crowd the south bank of the Rocky Basin. Once, when I was gazing at them from the rock cliff at the pool's edge, their blue-green needles gave me the impression I had entered a Maxfield Parrish painting. Now the woolly adelgid, an invasive species from East Asia, threatens the hemlock's survival. The woolly adelgid is but one of many insects, stowaways of international shipping, that have no native predators and ecosystems east of the Mississippi. Others include the spotted lanternfly, the emerald ash borer, the Asian longhorned beetle, and the brown marmorated stink bug. By the mid-19th century, European settlers had cut down most of the hemlocks to use their bark for tanning leather, a lucrative enterprise that lasted as long as the trees did. The other deforestation culprit was the so-called merino craze, which came to America after the Napoleonic Wars, when the merino breed of sheep spread from Europe. The explosion of shepherding completed the shift from forest to open pasture. Because of the forest loss, new channels and floodplains eroded what little topsoil the Frost Valley had introduced, eroded what little topsoil the Frost Valley had and introduce sheep manure to the river, increasing plant and insect life. As more productive regions emerged out west after the Civil War, shepherding died out in upstate New York and New England, but the damage was done. The first growth hemlocks were no more. Over my grandmother's lifetime, the Catskills reforested with second growth hardwoods, maples, cherry, ash, birch, and on the lower reaches, oak. These did little to mitigate the loss of hemlocks, which had destabilized the West Branch and allowed the river to sweep from side to side of the valley to the other, grinding boulders to rocks and rocks to sand. For most of the 20th century, the water cycle fell into something like a pattern. The quiet of winter's ice, spasms of spring thaws and summer floods, the steady procession of fall rains through October and November. And then, in the second decade of the 21st century, the pattern broke.
So I asked Hovey to stop there, a bit of a cliffhanger. In part because the full essay is really wonderful, and so I want to encourage you to read it all. But there where Hovey stopped, we begin to get into the present day and the things which have happened over the past decade. And Hovey and I talked a lot more about those issues and more about the Neversink and more about his larger project, which is more than just the writing that he's done. It's also visual art, it's paintings, videos, and more. So I want to play a bit of our conversation. Let's go back to Hovey. Just queuing it up here. Okay, here's my chat with Hovey.
When I had checked to ensure the box was free of wasps, bees.
That didn't sound like Hovey, did it? Okay, here we go.
Project was really, it all came out of this experience that I had on the West Branch of the Neversink, where, you know, I've grown up. Really, it was a combination of the Irene flood, and then the following year there was this incredible localized storm, kind of a rain bomb, where you got like 10 inches of rain in 4 hours. So, I mean, you know, it's a cranky river to begin with. So when it got that, it was an insane amount of damage. So it was like a 1-2 punch. And it was out of that that I said, oh, this is what the new normal is going to be. And I decided to make a project out of trying to commemorate the river that I had known and then the river that I was going to be encountering with climate change. I've been doing a series of paintings that have been based on my writing, and also bringing in other, material. And I have been involved in writing also about it. This piece in the Appalachian Journal is the first one that I've gotten published. There are others that I want to publish, but I haven't gotten around to finishing them yet. So we'll see how that works out. But, you know, there is a visual arts piece, and then there's a writing piece. And, you know, I think of those as basically joined at the hip. There's one kind of feeds off the other. Like, I literally, in the paintings, I write on the paintings. You can see, like, there's writing on it that refers to a number of things, you know, invasive species, memories of my family. I try to keep it from being too didactic in terms of, like, you know, we are suffering climate change. I mean, we all know that's happening. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to give a very personal sense of how climate change is impacting me, and hopefully meeting people with their feelings about that, you know, having to deal with it. And, you know, it's I think it's a huge issue, and it's going to get worse as people are in climate change shock. You know, having to deal with a situation where, you know, they had a situation that was, you know, pleasant or at least not threatening, and then having to deal with a situation that's gotten a lot more dangerous. I mean, I'll give you an example. You know, 30 years ago, there were no ticks in my area of the Catskills. None. There were no ticks. And now, you know, it's a real problem. You know, like last year was really bad. There were, you know, you would go out in the woods and you'd come back and there'd be like, you know, 4 or 5 ticks, sometimes 10 on you. So, you know, these are things that, you know, we must deal with as a species. But, you know, I'm trying to get to how does it actually feel for me? And then maybe if I'm really honest about how that feels, that's a place where people can kind of land, if you will.
One of the things that was curious to me is you never portray, especially the river. So you call it the Crazy River, which is not it's not a term you came up with or a name you came up with, but you don't ascribe any negative adjectives really to the river. You know, you don't paint this river, which has become quite crazy and done some quite crazy things to both people and animals and valleys and areas. But anyway, you don't really ascribe any negative characteristics to it.
That's a really interesting observation. I would have never noticed that myself. I mean, I love that piece of the river. It's just been a really important part of my life and, you know, the members of my family. And, you know, it's just something out there that I couldn't ascribe anything evil to it, because there's no intention of evil, or, you know, it just is, you know, but, you know, I mean, I can ascribe evil intentions to people because, you know, they have intentionality, but a river doesn't. So the original inhabitants called it crazy, but, you know, who knows what crazy actually meant in their language. You know, that's our translation. So, you know, maybe crazy for them was, you know, you don't know what's going to happen next with this one. You know, I mean, you know, who knows, right? But so that may, I mean, I know crazy in our language has a negative connotation, but, you know, it may not have had for the Lenape.
Hovey Brock talking about his essay, Crazier River. The Neversink River Goes Rogue in the Climate Crisis. That's coming out in the New Appalachia Journal. I also encourage you to check out Hovey Brock's work. The paintings are really wonderful. They're on his website. I will have links to all of this work. We'll be back in just a moment with Leslie Sharp and Bluebirds. I am a comedy of errors today. Okay. Unfortunately, it's my playlist. Just having a moment here. I don't know if it's my Wi-Fi. But I have an album as backup, so please hold. Thank you. Always have vinyl backup. That is the soundtrack recording from Fellini's Juliet of the Spirits, composed by Nino Rota. From 1965, we might be hearing a little bit more from that. I have all sorts of vinyl backup. That's the great news. The better news is that I'm going to play an excerpt now from Leslie Sharp, reading from The Bluebird Chronicles, A Catskills Romance. It's an essay she wrote for the Appalachia Journal, coming out in January. You, of course, know Leslie Sharp because she's been on this show before, and she's a great friend to the Ginger Newsletter. She's a writer and naturalist, and I'm going to let her take it away with this wonderful excerpt from her essay.
A European starling alights on the cedarwood nesting box. It starts to peck at the small round entrance hole as if trying to widen it. Get away, I scream, rushing down the steps of my front deck and across the lawn to the meadow's edge, waving my hands at the startled starling, a notorious bully and glutton of the bird world, who retreats swiftly and, I am sure, sullenly. This is the bluebird's second nest of the season, sheltered in the box that is securely affixed to the sturdy pine post. The courting male, once he has chosen his domicile, attracts the female by fluttering his wings and flying into the box with nesting material. If his lady love approves, and bluebird females, as I have seen, can be very fussy, she will fly to him and enter the box, thus solidifying their bond. I watched in early spring at my home in the Catskills foothills of upstate New York as Mrs. Bluebird resolutely built her first nest with strands of grass. I would discover, when I had checked to ensure the box was free of wasps, bees, and other pests, that she had threaded the soft, pale grasses with pine needles and added, as embellishments, several turkey feathers. The nest itself was neat, cup-shaped, and several inches high, which would allow the nestlings, when it was time for them to fledge, easy access to the opening. The male, who cedes nest building to his mate, though diligently conducting daily inspections, sat nearby in the yellow cedar tree, serenading her with his soft, warbling, too-a-wee song while she worked. He was also her resolute guardian and assiduous chaperone, swooping down on any other bird that ventured near, another male bluebird rival for her attentions, or even a wild turkey, an imposing tom in full breeding regalia, his feathers iridescent in the sharp spring sunlight, strutting and fanning, oblivious of all save his own coy, modest females. Yet as fierce as the male bluebird acted in defense of his nest, and therefore his own genetic imperative, he was unfailingly tender to his mate. He flew into the box on those chilly early spring mornings with a wriggling worm or some other tasty tidbit to feed her as she sat on the eggs, incubating them. If she left the nest box to hunt for herself or simply to sit in the yellow cedar tree, mothers of all species, it seems, need a break, he would enter the box and, I assumed, resume the vigil until she returned to ensure that the eggs stayed warm. Papa, as I soon called him, also proved to be a devoted father. From dawn to dusk, the bluebirds worked together to feed their ravenous young, bringing them offerings of small invertebrates. Painful to see a pretty tiger swallowtail butterfly disappearing into the box. They sat atop the flagpole in the front yard, an excellent vantage point from which the bluebirds can spy ants, slugs, and caterpillars lurking in the grass, then spiraled down to the ground and snatched their prey, carrying it daintily back to the nest box, though Mama had to battle to hold on to a cricket. Sometimes they would just sit there together, Mama and Papa, and preen each other, behavior far more modest than the tree swallow's antics, the cheeky occupants of a nearby nest box who made it acrobatically and repeatedly atop the flagpole. In the 20 years I have lived on this mountain, I have experienced firsthand the changing climate and its harmful effects on birds, whose populations already suffer from habitat loss, pesticides, and the dangers of spring and fall migrations. Bluebirds, especially, as early and enthusiastic first nesters, are vulnerable to the increasingly erratic weather. A January warm spell, not just a thaw, but a week of temperatures approaching 70 degrees Fahrenheit, makes me hold my breath, hoping the bluebirds, ever eager, won't arrive yet. If they do, their nest building quickly falls prey to the cold, inevitable and cruel, and the loss of food as the insects they depend on disappeared. I have opened the nest box and found the bluebird parents, who haven't even finished their nest, dead from the elements. It is heartbreaking to see such vibrant, beautiful creatures so still. Conversely, several seasons ago, after a seemingly normal spring of gradually rising temperatures, the last snowstorm on the mountain came in mid-May. That year's pair already had nestlings in the box, and there was no food for the little family. Every morning I was outside at dawn, clearing snow, which kept drifting and putting out mealworms, a favorite bluebird food. They took them gratefully, a relief to me, as bluebirds won't always accept such gifts from humans, an indication of their desperation, no doubt. Mama bluebird would fly to the deck rail, peering in at me through the living room window, as if to say thank you. I was thrilled when I saw five bluebird fledglings flying after their beleaguered parents later that spring. But snow, at least for the little ones in their box, is insulating. Perhaps most dangerous to bluebirds and other early nesters such as tree swallows is the fact that Catskill Springs have become colder and wetter, lasting longer with chilly, penetrating rains. The nest box, though not a perfect haven, offers a home for so many species and a way that humans, providing this habitat, can make a real difference in the life and survival of all sorts of birds, from wrens to chickadees to owls, and songbirds such as the bluebird.
See, I promised hope. Leslie Sharp. The essay is called The Bluebird Chronicles, A Catskills Romance, by writer and naturalist Leslie Sharp, who lives in the great western Catskills, and of course wrote the wonderful book, The Quarry Fox. So I promised hope, I promised cataclysms, we've had a little bit of both. But let's listen to some more music. I have so much backup vinyl, as I mentioned. Simone with I Like the Sunrise. It's from a wonderful album that was gifted to me recently. It's called Nina Simone Sings Ellington, but there's an exclamation point at the end. So it's really Nina Simone Sings Ellington. So we're going to keep playing some vinyl here. Next up is Wawa Watson. And here we go.
Thank you.
Comparable Wawa Watson with Sunset Boulevard. I want to thank Hovey and Leslie for taking the time last week to speak with me and read excerpts from their essay. I want to make one more plug for the Appalachia Journal. Again, the new issue, winter spring issue, is coming out in January. The theme is Cataclysms in the Catskills and Taconics. That's us right here. You can subscribe to the journal if you go to outdoors.org/resources/Appalachia. I will have links in the show notes, both at justinmaiman.com and on the WGXC Ginger Radio Hour website. So please go there for much more information. Again, I appreciate the time that Hovey and Leslie took. But also, I really encourage you to check these essays out. And there's so much more in that journal. I haven't gotten to see it all yet. But it looks beautiful. Thank you all very much for joining me on Ginger Radio Hour today. I have one more selection I want to play. Again, from Juliet of the Spirits. We'll bring it up quietly. It seems like everything's going to be all right when you listen to the beginning of this. But there are tempo changes, beware. Again, this is from Fellini's Juliet of the Spirits, the movie composed, the music composed by Nino Rota. And there's the bass. Foreboding. Okay, I'll get out of your ears now. But listen to this and have a wonderful week.